This episode is brought to you by Progressive, where drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. Plus, auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Quote now at progressive.com to see if you could save. Progressive Casualty Insurance and Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Hey everyone, this is Lily Sullivan. You may know me from I Think You Should Leave or The Righteous Gemstones, or you might know me as Francesca Bolognese, or more recently, Tony Soul New York on Comedy Bang Bang. I want to wish Comedy Bang Bang a happy 15th anniversary. This show is the size of a freaking head, and I am incredibly grateful to be a part of it. So I'd like to give a huge thank you to the world's biggest hentai addict, Scott Aukerman. He's the best. Just like my gooma. You can hear me and a lot of other funny people on Comedy Bang Bang wherever you get your podcasts.
The year is 2002, and we're going to be talking about this latest head.
I don't know what I'm going to say in this episode. There's so much to say, but I feel like a fucking idiot. I mean, what if I read all the wrong things into it? I mean, I don't even know. I mean, everyone's going to fucking attack me on the Discord, you fucking dummy.
The movie adaptation. Everyone, and welcome to
Unspooled.
I'm Amy Nicholson.
And I am Paul Scheer, and this is the podcast where we are trying to find the best movies of all time. And it is also the first time we are back in the studio. Amy, look at this. Very exciting.
I love it. Do you think if I give you a high five across the table, the sound of palm versus palm will be audible?
I mean, definitely. I mean, this is a high-tech scoop.
Here we go. One, boom. Two, three.
There we go. You heard it. We're here in the same space. Things are getting kind of back to normal. So I'm curious about how this is going to be. You know, I went to my first Alamo Drafthouse movie. I saw Sonic 2 with my kids.
Not bad. Not a bad movie.
I love Sonic 1. And I thought, and I think I talked about this a little bit last week, Sonic 2 did an amazing job of like making that mythology digestible and really fun.
Like, I love it.
It's crazy. You have a giant robot fighting. I'm like, I'm in. It felt much more realistic, and I don't mean to slight this, Raven, than Pacific Rim.
On
that level, you know, if you're saying Sonic 2 is better than Pacific Rim, I'll take that bet.
Fair enough. I went to go see, if we're talking about what we saw this weekend.
Yeah.
I went to UCLA to see an old movie from Anita Loos, you know, the like female screenwriter who like would grow up to do Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, but she was around since the silent era, since the 19 teens, when she was a teenager herself. She did a movie in the early 30s called San Francisco, and it is a musical disaster romance starring Clark Gable as like a saloon keeper right before the big earthquake of 1906.
Whoa.
2 hours long, very, very long.
Yes.
But like epic. And watching it, I was like, oh, James Cameron 1,000% watched this before Titanic. 1,000. They even do a Nearer My God to the bit at the end. And I was like, oh, okay.
Oh, I'm excited. You won me over. I got to check that out. It's so great to see like classic big movies on like the big screen. I feel like it has a weight that's different. And I'm so excited because this Friday, by the time you listen to this, it will be done. I'm going to be at Lily Tomlin's screening of All of Me, which is going to be coinciding with her getting her star on the Walk of Fame. And to see that movie, like Lily Tomlin and Steve Martin together in a movie, like in a crowded theater, while it's a little scary to be in a crowded theater, it is so fun. I can't wait to see like a Lily Tomlin movie on the big screen like that.
Oh, I'm so glad you're doing that. I'm so glad she's getting her star on the Walk of Fame.
Yes.
I wrote the article about her getting her star for Variety that's coming up because I love Lily Tomlin myself. Man, she should have gotten her star like decades ago, but I'm so happy she's getting it now. Like her comedy, writing about her getting her star in the Walk of Fame gave me an excuse to go back and like listen to all of her comedy albums from the past. Like she just was so cutting edge in the 70s. And I adore her. We got to talk about her a bit when we did Nashville.
Yeah.
The movie that she got in her very first movie gets an Academy Award supporting actor nomination for it, like right out of the box. She's just such a talent. I adore her.
I got to watch her work a handful of times on Grace and Frankie. And it's amazing to see her put together a scene because you can watch it on stage and you're like, this is fantastic. And then when you watch it at home, it feels totally different. I don't know how to describe it. It just, she pops in both regards. It's not like, oh, you see her on set and it looks not right. And then on film, it pops. It's like she is bringing it both ways. I'm in awe of her. And in the time I've spent with her in these last years, I always wanted like just needle her for information because she's been at the center of so many amazing things, had so many amazing interactions, and seems sort of like, yeah. I'll ask her something and she's like, oh yeah. She's not going to give you a big story about it, but I just want to get in there. And are you going to be there on Friday?
No, okay. No. But I'm very jealous that you are. That sounds like so fun.
I think it'll be a blast.
And just, you know, when I was going back and researching about her, I found an article where from the 70s where Lorne Michaels was calling her just like the future of comedy in the 70s. That the way she was like doing portraits of women and capturing like the essence and writing jokes that weren't even like necessarily funny, but you felt like it was empathetic comedy.
Yeah.
That her type of comedy in a time of the 70s where people are like punching down and being mean, especially even the 70s going into 80s, everybody being like joke, making fun of people. She turned comedy into a way of just like making you care about women you would never meet, but that you sort of knew and that you sort of saw yourself in. Groundbreaking stuff that I still feel like she did better than anyone I can think of today.
Well, and you know, I just want to shout out, you know, Jane Wagner as mm-hmm. well, because Jane Wagner is her partner, but also her creative partner. And a lot of the stuff that you love of Lily is from Jane. You know, Jane has been such a large part of her career and they are one. And it's really amazing to see. I don't even know where one begins and one ends as far as like what was coming out in that creative era where she was doing those shows. Yeah.
Like when Lily got a star on the Palm Springs Walk of Fame, she made a point of saying Jane's name has to be on it here with me too.
I love that.
So I feel like the Lily star, when I look at it, I feel like I'll see Jane Wagner there underneath it, even if the name doesn't say it. I feel like it's if you know, you know.
Yeah.
Right?
You know, it's so interesting. We're coming across this totally organically, but this idea of who is behind the scenes. Today's movie that we're talking about, Adaptation, really talks about this idea of like, who is responsible for some of this creation? Oftentimes, I think writers are overlooked. Obviously, everyone talks about Sorkin and you hear about Shonda Rhimes. There are a handful of writers that are writer celebrities. But for the most part, writers toil away behind the scenes. People that are in the know, that's how they get their next jobs. But, you know, so many people work on scripts. There are so many names attached to projects. I don't know if you know about this, but the WGA is just working on this new way of representing writers. So if you've done a year of work on a script and then it gets made, but your script has been rewritten or, you know, only a small part has stayed, you will still be able to have a credit for that. Because for a long time, writers will just be thrown at scripts and then they throw them off, put them on, and oftentimes the arbitration process, like this idea of who gets credit for the script, is a very tricky thing.
And knowing that as a critic, it makes it hard to talk about the writing in your review because you don't actually know if the person that you're crediting or blaming wrote the line that you're even like have a problem with. You know, like you have no idea the actual story. It's sort of like the more you know about how movies get made, the harder it is to write a review where you feel like in any position to say what went wrong.
Yeah, it's a very interesting world we live in because you could be incredibly successful and you could have nothing to show for it. Like this idea that you are writing, you're working on great projects, you're handing in great scripts, but there are so many obstacles to get that script made. And then even when it gets made, to get credit for it because other people come in and there's sneaky ways of getting credit. Like, you know, there's a trick that people used to use, and I think they still do. If I'm rewriting your script, I go in and I change all the characters' names and you write a movie about New York and I change it to Boston. That way, when an arbiter at the WGA sits down and looks at it, they go, well, I mean, 75% of the script is totally different. The other script took place in New York. This takes place in Boston. That character was called Molly. That character now is called Raven. You know, it's like you can flip everything around. And it's this really hard thing to fight for credit. I've watched it up close millions of times. And it's, yeah, I just think it's really interesting to get into a movie about writing and the toll it takes, because it truly is the unsung hero in this world. We celebrate big, big movies. And I think, you know, you'd be hard pressed to talk about who wrote a lot of your favorite films.
It's true. I feel like the cautionary tale that I always think of, you know, coming at this from the critical point of view, is the story of like Joan Didion and her husband John Dunn doing the movie that they wanted to do on Jessica Savage. She was like a newspaper reporter who had a lot of drinking and drug problems, and they wanted to make a true story about her. And then it got turned in over like the adaptation and adaptation and adaptation process into like a romantic comedy with Michelle Pfeiffer. And that had nothing to do with their movie at all. And it was just like such an egregious warping of like the original creative seed of it, that like Dunn wrote his own book about it, Monster. Like, and just the story of like how an idea in Hollywood can mutate into something beyond your control if you're a screenwriter.
So interesting. Well, what a great way to get into today's episode. So Amy, instead of unspooling it, why don't we unwrite it? I don't know if that's any good. The year is 2002. The former CFO of Enron is indicted on 78 counts of wire fraud and money laundering. George Bush creates the Department of Homeland Security in order to fight the Axis of Evil. U.S. Airways, WorldCom, and Kmart file for bankruptcy. If you don't know this, Amy, there are only two Kmarts left in the country as of today.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah,
I know.
Well, where else will all of the TV stars of the 80s sell their towels?
Well, we'll have to get our Kathy Ireland leggings somewhere else. Former U.S. President Jimmy Carter wins the Nobel Peace Prize for dedicating his life to peace and democracy. And the hot films of this year are Chicago, Lord of the Rings, The Two Towers, Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets, Jackass the Movie, and today's film adaptation. Amy, who's in it? What's it about? And what was on the radio?
Adaptation, directed by Spike Jonze and written by Charlie Kaufman and his identical twin brother, Donald Kaufman, both of whom are on screen and both of whom are played by Nicolas Cage. Adaptation is about Charlie's struggles to write a screenplay for the Susan Orlean nonfiction book, The Orchid Thief. In that book itself is an adaptation of like Orlean writing her New Yorker piece called Orchid Fever, where she profiled this man from Florida named John LaRote, who is passionate about orchids. Susan Orlean had a really hard time turning her journalism New Yorker piece into a book. Kaufman had a really hard time turning her book into a screenplay. His solution was to insert himself and Susan, who's played by Meryl Streep, and John, who's played by Chris Cooper, into the story, along with his totally real twin brother Donald, who studied screenwriting at a 3-day Robert McKee seminar and embraces writing movies that Charlie thinks are super cliche and dumb and totally not at all what he, the genius brother, would want to write. Take a listen.
She hates me. She's disappointed. I could see it in her eyes when we met. I've got to stop sweating. Oh, she looked at my hairline. She thinks I'm bald. She's thinking I would never in a million years sleep with this guy.
We think you're great.
Oh, thanks. Wow, that's nice to hear.
True story. The Oscars played along and nominated both Charlie and Donald Kaufman for the Best Adapted Screenplay Oscar.
Well, not the first time, because Robert Towne wrote Greystoke, The Legend of Tarzan, Lord of the Apes, under a pseudonym, and he was nominated, or his pseudonym was nominated, for an Academy Award, which must be a bummer when you try to take your name off a movie and then it gets nominated and you can't retroactively go back. And do you want people to know? Do you not want people to know? That is a tricky one. I mean, I see like when Soderbergh, you know, puts down like Logan Lucky had a screenwriter that no one knew. And people don't know who wrote Logan Lucky. Could it have been him? Could it have been his wife? There are so many theories on who wrote Logan Lucky and the idea that you want to stay anonymous. That movie was successful. At one point, you'd be like, I actually wrote it. But I love that idea that there's like a little bit of a thrill in staying behind the scenes.
I know. Although, alas for Charlie and Donald, they lost the Oscar. Do you remember what they lost it to?
Oh, it's going to make me so upset. No, I don't. What did they lose it to?
The Pianist.
Which seems like the perfect award film. Like it just, I have not seen it. I'm sure it's great. I don't want to Emperor's New Groove this, but I will say that this movie, from a writing standpoint, is one of the most interesting films. You could argue one of the most interesting films in the pantheon of screenwriting, right? Like yeah. The Pianist feels like I can give you 10 films in that genre that are probably equal to that movie.
Yeah, I haven't seen The Pianist either, but I have to say it doesn't feel like a necessary screenplay to watch.
No, no.
But maybe that's just being me being harsh. Anyway, Adaptation was not a huge box office winner, but it did make a big impression on people, I would say bigger than The Pianist, and it added to the legend of Charlie Kaufman as a writer who is too smart and too neurotic to have an easy go of it in the world. Kind of like the number one hit on the Billboard charts when Adaptation was released on December 6, 2002. This is a song that's about writing. It's about writer's block. It's about nervous perspiration, which we have Charlie Kaufman having in this film. It's about having a tenuous grip on your own reality as a wordsmith. It's this.
Yo. His palms are sweaty, knees weak, arms are heavy. There's vomit on his sweater already. Mom's spaghetti, he's nervous.
How dare you? How dare you trick me like that?
It's not a trick.
No.
Has there ever been a movie more about losing yourself than
Adaptation? No, I mean, my gosh. Well, this is a big year for self-reflection, right? Because, I mean, 8 Mile's about Eminem and telling his story as Eminem. This is Charlie Kaufman telling his story. I mean, he's not in it. I mean, he is technically in it for about a frame or two when Nicolas Cage looks into the mirror at one point. It's a reflection of Charlie Kaufman.
Oh, just like what happened in the other Winning Time when Pat Riley was looking at himself.
Wait, really?
Yeah.
Wow. I gotta check that out. I'm a little bit behind.
It's getting better.
I was on since episode 3. I just have been watching so many movies for shows like this that it precludes me from watching things for pure enjoyment. I want to talk about this movie, and I'm nervous that we'll never get to fully unpack it the way that I want to. But I know you're such a Charlie Kaufman fan. Where does this fall for you in the pantheon of Kaufman films?
To be honest, in my Charlie Kaufman pantheon, I would put Adaptation as a lesser Kaufman.
Really?
I would.
Okay,
break
it down.
I would. It's not my favorite Kaufman. I feel like what happens in Adaptation, him trying to show that he can tell a story that winds up being about everything and his struggle to do it and his sort of collapse and being able to do it and then like turning Adaptation into this like meta-reflection. I think that's all interesting as like a parlor game. But I think he winds up doing what he wants to do in Adaptation originally with Synecdoche, New York. You know, and I feel like there's so much in Synecdoche that like comes from this experience of being on the Adaptation set, because it's about being a writer, casting somebody to play yourself, that person casting somebody else, and all these like mirrors of reflections, like the Spider-Man meme where they're all pointing at each other. To have him be on set and see Nicolas Cage, and Nicolas Cage looking at him, and Nicolas Cage being like, this is so surreal, I'm going crazy. I think he takes all of that experience plus his passion of wanting of what he wanted to do with Adaptation, puts it into Synecdoche, and then that is his masterpiece.
I love Synecdoche, and I know so many people do not love it, and I think it's an incredibly dark movie. I have no issue with it, but I will say what I think Spike Jonze does so well with Charlie Kaufman is the humanity. And I think without Spike Jonze, you're left with a bleaker movie in the sense that, not that this is like the most uplifting film, but I think he's able to take everything that Charlie Kaufman does and imbue it with a little hope, a little bit more emotion without undercutting it. I'm not saying like, oh, he makes it rosy, but I think he's able to find why we like it. Like, for example, this movie really meanders for about 90 minutes, you know, and you're so captivated by the performances and the world, or at least I am, that you don't even realize there's no movie happening. It's sort of this, you know, long story that you're waiting for the point to get to, but you're so caught up in it. And I think that in someone else's hands, and maybe even Charlie Kaufman's hands, is like boring. And I think Spike Jonze is able to keep these plates spinning, make you lean forward, feel and care about these people. And I also want to put that on Nick Cage too. I think Nick Cage brings something. This is a really tough character to like. I've heard people go like, well, you know, Charlie Kaufman's like Woody Allen. He's not. He's much darker than Woody Allen. Like, what, you know, the Woody Allen that we know from film. Like, he is like Woody Allen is New York miserable, like a fun, like, oh, I'm complaining. And Larry David, it's light. It's airy. This is a sweaty mess of a person. And I think it all is encapsulated in that beautiful scene with Judy Greer when he asks her to go to the festival. Like that scene is a gut punch. I mean, that's unvarnished. Oh, it gets me in my heart so much. And I feel like that balance is what Spike Jonze is able to do. The performances are letting it rise up a little bit.
I mean, I like a dark. I think that like the sadness of Synecdoche is so beautiful. But yeah, I mean, to your point, I think when Woody Allen makes fun of himself, he's like making fun of how he thinks other people might think of him, but he thinks he's a badass,
mm-hmm.
you know? Whereas I think Charlie Kaufman, when you have an intro like this right here, he kind of means it.
Do I have an original thought in my head? My bald head? Maybe if I were happier, my hair wouldn't be falling out. Life is short. I need to make the most of it. Today's the first day of the rest of my life. I'm a walking cliche. I really need to go to the doctor, have my leg checked. There's something wrong. A bump. The dentist called again. I'm way overdue. If I stopped putting things off, I would be happier. All I do is sit on my fat ass. If my ass wasn't fat, I would be happier. I wouldn't have to wear these shirts with the tails out all the time. Like that's fooling anyone.
I mean, of course, with like one big caveat, which is like all of the neuroses that he's giving his Charlie Kaufman on screen are not actually his. Like Charlie Kaufman is not balding. He's not fat. He has a full head of hair and he's always been really thin. So at least he's like making up different neuroses.
Well, he makes up that he has a brother. I mean, so many people thought that he had a brother. I mean, besides the fact that he co-credits him as the writer, it's like
but the what I mean beginning, is middle, and end. He's not making fun of himself for what he probably worries about. You know, he's like making fun of himself for like a whole new set of worries that he actually doesn't have. He gives himself a little bit of a buffer.
To just continue this Woody Allen comparison, then we'll leave it because I think this is much greater than Woody Allen. Woody Allen, to me, is someone who is above it all. And Charlie Kaufman, in his representations of himself, is someone who can't get out of the muck, right? Like he's not smarter than everyone else. You know,
he's kind of aware that he thinks he's smarter than everybody else, and he's mad at himself for thinking that.
Yeah, there's a weird difference there. There's a cockiness to a Larry David or a Woody Allen, even with the neuroses, that seems self-aware but also confident. And this
like,
is maybe self-aware.
Like me,
and
it's your problem.
Yes. Now, I'll tell you this, Amy.
Where Kaufman's like, if you don't like me, I probably did something wrong.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, absolutely. That's a beautiful way of putting it.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Post James Brown syncopated ghost notes on the snare. This is just like boom, cat.
I love Bruno Mars. I think I could play that.
There's nothing complicated, but that's kind of, that's the genre.
Hi, I'm director and sometimes DJ Diallo Riddle.
And I'm producer and songwriter Luxury.
And this is One Song, a podcast where we celebrate and deconstruct some of your favorite songs from the last 60 years and tell you why they deserve one more listen. Follow and listen to One Song on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I can't tell you that I've related to a character more than this character. Like that.
Really?
Oh my God. Yes.
But you're such a sunny guy.
I mean, this movie speaks to me from like an emotional place more than like this character. 1,000,000%. I was like, I think, yes.
Is this your inner monologue?
Oh, absolutely.
Really?
Absolutely. Yes. 100%. And then like, you know, it's like, there is something about this movie and watching it now and seeing it older that I think I'm a lot more able to like identify with. Like before, I was like, this is so cool. I love it. And like Charlie Kaufman is such an interesting guy. He's playing himself and that's his brother, blah, 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 blah. And I think what I really got this time was this fight, this internal fight of these voices inside of you, because the brothers are two voices, right? It's like it is what I love about the movie is like the three, the movie that his brother is writing, the thriller that's Silence of the Lambs, you know, what is it, meets Sybil.
You want to hear my pitch?
Go away, goddammit.
Hey, thanks a lot, buddy. Cool. Okay, there's a serial killer, right? Well, no, wait. And he's being hunted by a cop, and he's taunting the cop, right? Sending clues who his next victim is. He's already holding her hostage in his creepy basement. So the cop gets obsessed with figuring out her identity, and in the process, falls in love with her. Even though he's never even met her. She becomes like the unattainable, like the Holy Grail.
It's a little obvious, don't you think?
Okay, but here's the twist. We find out that the killer really suffers from multiple personality disorder, right? See, he's actually really the cop and the girl. All of them are him. Isn't that fucked up?
The only idea more overused than serial killers is multiple personality.
Like, in a weird way, he's making fun of multiple personalities in a movie where a character is playing all roles, and he's also doing that in this movie. I mean, you know, there's an element to him when his brother where his brother represents maybe the side of him that he wants to be or the side that he's too critical to be. You know, do you put yourself down so much that you can't achieve? And I think he's looking at himself and saying, well, I can go in two roads, but I keep myself on this road. And I think that's it's a very interesting debate, which is why the third act pops so much, because the idea is like he combines both parts of himself to make a movie that really pops and makes an ending that is amazing. And then with the death of his more popular or more confident brother, he is able to, you know, merge. He becomes back to one. And it's not multiple personality per se, but it is a personification of personality.
I mean, it's kind of a magic trick, right?
Yeah.
Where he is like, but it's a magic trick at the beginning. He's like, I'm going to do this. I'm sawing this woman in half. Pretty corny, maybe. I don't know. Sawing a woman in half, kind of over it. But by the time he saws the woman in half, you're like, oh, that's a magic trick. That's so marvelous. Well done.
Yeah.
You know, like he sets up the idea that it's dumb and then somehow like wants to pull it off and makes it work.
Well, that 90 minutes that I'm
saying.
But it's
also like a mea culpa, too. It's like, oh, he's like apologizing for what he's doing as he's doing it and then also trying to wow you with doing it. He kind of covers all of his emotional bases.
Which is why at the end of the movie, it doesn't feel like the 90 minutes were wasted, right? You might feel if you're watching this for the first time, you walk out after 90 minutes, like, what was he doing? I don't know. Like, what did I see? But every little piece builds to that end. It all was layered in there. And it is that trick. It's like all the hints were there. It's that Usual Suspects. It's an emotional Usual Suspects. It really does pull you in.
Well, it is. Yeah. It's like you when you finish the movie, then you like rewind to the very opening scene where he's like sitting down with his producer, Tilda Swinton, playing Valerie Thomas, who like was the producer on this movie, named her after the person he was working
Love
with
it.
On this movie, named his agent that Ron Livingston is playing against about his like real agent, Marty Bowen, who, by the way, did you know that Marty Bowen went on to do the Twilight films?
Really?
Well done, Marty Bowen.
Wow, there he is.
Yeah, yeah. He's not just the guy making jokes about doing people up the ass. But he like puts in that scene where he's like sitting down with Tilda Swinton as the real Valerie, describing everything he doesn't want his movie to be, which is exactly what it becomes.
I guess I'm not exactly sure what that means.
Oh. I'm not sure I know what that means either. I just don't want to ruin it by making it a Hollywood thing, you know, like an Orchid Heist movie or something, you know, you know, changing the orchids into poppies and turning into a movie about drug running, you know? Why can't there be a movie simply about flowers?
I guess we thought that maybe Susan, Orlean, and LaRoche could fall in love.
Okay, but I'm saying it's like I don't want to cram in sex or guns or car chases, you know, or characters, you know, learning profound life lessons or growing or coming to like each other or overcoming obstacles to succeed in the end. You know, I mean, it's the book isn't like that. And life isn't like that. You know, it just isn't.
I mean, that moment in the hotel room, that's the Donald script, right? Like the Charlie script is until the hotel room, and then the Donald script is after that, because the minute Donald comes in and goes to interview Meryl Streep, who, by the way, I know there's a lot of talk about how amazing Nicolas Cage is in this movie, and it is, and we are coming to this to talk about Nicolas Cage, and I think we will get into this a little bit more, but he's fantastic. But Meryl Streep gives one of the most, like I love a Meryl Streep performance like this. It's joyful, it's so nuanced, and as the movie changes, she changes, and it's a lot. She is truly the other magician that you're like, oh my, wait, that's the same person? Like, you don't even realize her switch. Like, you know, Nicolas Cage is definitely in front, almost distracting you from the change that's going on there. Because by the end of the film, what you see with Meryl Streep, when she is like trying to kill him as a drug addict.
She's got like red rims around her eyes. Yeah. Like there's something in the way that she's like this passionate, sweaty woman in the swamp that's so different from the manicured Susan Orlean at the very beginning.
Yeah.
She's just like a totally radical kind of like animal woman, like when she's like in it getting high with Chris Cooper.
Yeah, and Chris Cooper as well. Like that sequence where I love this story, this love story. And that is going on in the Charlie script. Like this love story that starts off with him like saying, I don't want to do a love story, right? Yeah. I don't want her to fall in love. That's what we hear in the beginning of the movie. But throughout the film, as we're in that world, the orchid thiefed world, it's one of the most beautiful love stories. And I love that moment where
you think it's a beautiful love story?
Oh, I do. I mean, because she knows who she has to be. She knows who she is as the New Yorker writer, right? And she comes back home and she's making fun of this hick, this Southern guy, and she's entertaining all of her friends. And when she goes to the bathroom and feels that betrayal, like, I don't really feel this way. I'm expected to feel this way. And
yeah, I love that idea. I love that scene for kind of showing that she's rooted in this cynicism where she's supposed to be like a keen observer of people.
Yeah.
But also to not care about them in the slightest. Which you see, like, when she gets into his van and she's just, like, smells funny.
Yeah.
Delusions of grandeur, like, writing down all these kind of mean notes about him at this remove.
Well, yeah, she is, you know, it's very typical to a romantic comedy. Oh, I hate you. I would never connect with you. And that moment in the bathroom, you know, she never says, like, I love you. Or, I mean, we can't count the third act because the third act is a whole different thing. But those little moments of seeing her wrestle with who she is. I mean, it's the same wrestle that Charlie Kaufman has. Like, who am I? What am I trying to do? What am I trying to accomplish? And one of the most romantic parts of the movie to me is her calling him mid-movie. And, you know, he's like, hey, Susie Q. And they start having this conversation that leads into why he doesn't have his teeth. What's mm-hmm. going on here? And that story, which I totally forgot about, the way that he is the way he is, and then you start to understand like why he moves on from fossils to plants to whatever. He just...
Yeah, fuck fish.
Right.
I renounce fish. I vow to never set foot in the ocean again, which is true. That is what the real guy actually did.
It truly, to me, is this really... It's subtle. I'm not saying that they're going to go off and be married, but I think what she finds with him is this genuineness, this connection to a person. And, you know, maybe it's a little bit critical of the world of the reporter being flung into a different world and being there as an observer. I think we deal with that a lot in documentary. Like, are we there to make fun of these people? Are we there to embrace these people? And I think that what she is doing is she's connecting and caring. And in that connecting and caring, that's a type of love. Whether or not it's like, this is the person she's meant to be with, I don't know. But there's a part of me that you want to see them together.
I mean, you do you? He's like, he turns her into a person who's high all the time and wants to murder people. Like, to me,
well, she wants to murder people. Well, he doesn't want to.
He's brought her to a level where she feels like she has to murder. I mean,
I think you're taking a lot of power away from her by saying that.
Well, Yes, and I mean, he's the one who gives her drugs in the beginning.
Like he explains to her why
your first hit of orchid pollen is free. I mean, come on. There's a little bit of that. I think to the film's credit, what I like about John LaRoche is that he's kind of a scumbag. Every time you fall in love with him a little bit, the script reminds you, you know, maybe you should be keeping your distance. He has a beautiful speech when they're at the flower show. And he's talking about people finding their mate and, like, you know, propagation and, like, going forth.
There's a certain orchid looks exactly like a certain insect, so the insect is drawn to this flower. It's double, it's soulmate. And wants nothing more than to make love to it. After, the insect flies off, spots another soulmate flower and makes love to it, thus pollinating it. And neither the flower nor the insect will ever understand the significance of their lovemaking. I mean, how could they know that because of their little dance, the world lives? But it does, by simply doing what they're designed to do, something large and magnificent happens. In this sense, they show us how to live, how the only barometer you have is your heart. How, when you spot your flower, you can't let anything get in your way.
And, like, that's that scene where you have this pivot on him and you're like, oh, he's a poet. He's a poet. Look at him. He's so beautiful. He's, like, he's, like, in touch with the natural world. And then an hour later, he's, like, operating a porn site and being like, can't believe people pay to see these bitches, essentially. Like, he's everything. He's not just this romantic soul. I think if he was more of a, like, I don't know, Last of the Mohicans character or something, it would be a worse film. But I like that he's so scuzzy.
Yeah, me too. But I'm saying, what I think is so interesting about that is we are used to seeing an archetype of, like, what romance should be. Like, she should fall in love with this rugged guy that all of a sudden, you know, oh, our worlds are different, but he's perfect. No, people aren't perfect. Like, and it might be true. It might be true to the world. You know, I don't know how.
Like, I mean, there's imperfect and then there's running a porn site.
Right. But I mean, but there's also, like, running a porn site for money versus, like, exploiting people. And I feel like there is, like, this funny nature to him where he just feels like, I'm going to make money doing this now. Like, he doesn't, it seems good natured in a way. Like, I don't know why, like, yes, I know it's exploitative, but there is something about it that he doesn't seem to be, it seems like he's just getting naked pictures off the internet, then loading them up and charging people to look at them on his site. I mean, or at least that's my thought of it. I don't know. I mean, I guess what I think about it is it's an unvarnished picture of this person. And just because he does that mean that their connection isn't strong? Because that was at the same desk he's talking about when he's talking about losing his wife. And it's the same, you know, it's the same place that he's at where you understand, you know, why I think he does everything that he does.
Well, I think if Kaufman's goal was to write a movie that reflects real life, LaRoche is, to me, one of the most fascinating real life characters I've seen. Mm-hmm. Because he actually is a real person who actually did all of these things.
Well, so is Susan Orlean. I mean,
well, right, but Susan didn't do all these things. John actually did most of this stuff, which I think is really interesting.
So he did run a porn site.
Yeah, actually, this is from Susan Orlean writing about John. John said he went into porn because, quote, the thing is, the internet is cool. It's not going to die on me like some plant.
Well, there you go. I mean, that's his whole thing. He's, like, running that whole time.
Apparently, John also told Susan Orlean after he read The Orchid Thief, he said, you know, if you write a couple more books, you could turn into a pretty good writer.
That's amazing.
Which, by the way, speaking of Susan Orlean and, like, her genius and her articles being turned into movies, you know that she wrote the article Surf Girls of Maui that became Blue Crush. Same year as this.
Oh, wow.
It was a big year for Susan Orlean. Oh, and did you know, by the way, now I'm just, like, dropping some Susan Orlean facts. Mm-hmm. Did you know that Susan Orlean had only one other brush with Hollywood, mm-hmm. which is in the 70s, she was an extra for one film, and that film was The Deer Hunter with Meryl Streep.
Oh, wow. No, I didn't. Wow.
Isn't that wild? They actually talked about putting her in this film. They had, like, several ideas of how to put Susan herself in as a cameo. She was originally thinking about being the Judy Greer character, the waitress. And I think the reason that they cast Judy Greer is because Judy Greer has kind of some resemblance to Susan Orlean, who's like a gorgeous redhead. Then they thought that she would be like a woman who was in the grocery store where Charlie Kaufman was shopping. And he would look at this woman, and then this woman would look at her friend, and they would start gossiping, and he would start going down this tailspin of like how this woman was talking about him behind his back and stuff. So whatever she was going to do in this movie was going to be a way to make him extra nervous. I think my favorite part of the movie actually is just John LaRoche. Like even more than all of the Kaufman stuff and like the neuroses and like here's how Hollywood works and blah, 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 blah. To put this man on screen who's so complicated and so passionate, and I love him and I hate him, and I think he's just played masterfully by Chris Cooper, who does wind up winning the Best Supporting Actor for this.
And also not sure how to play him. Apparently, like, he told Spike Jonze, like, I need to do this on different levels so we can see, like, how much is too much, how much is not enough. So it is a process where he is, I think, testing things out on set, and you get this really interesting performance that at moments is, I think, again, to the point, like, that has levels and layers. It's not just a...
Yeah, he doesn't feel consistent because people aren't consistent. Right. And what I love about him at the center of this, I mean, to me, the movie kind of feels like all of these series of, like, rings, right? Mm-hmm. We have, like, the outer ring, which is, like, the Tilda ring, just like, we have this property, figure it out, and then the Kaufman ring right inside it, like, I don't know, I'm looking at the Susan Orlean book, and what do I do? And then the Susan ring... where she's looking at him and being like, what is my story? And he's this guy at the center who has so much like life and so many things that are interesting about him that the whole movie is just about people trying to capture who this guy is, you know?
Yeah.
And like him kind of looking around and like how different it is. Like that Susan is able to write a beautiful like little stanza about him where, you know, she describes him as like skinny as a stick, pale-eyed, slouch-shouldered, and sharply handsome despite of the fact that he's missing all his front teeth. Her next sentence is, he has the posture of El Dente Spaghetti and the nervous intensity of somebody who plays a lot of video games. That's what she writes in her actual column. And then to see it a step removed, to see Charlie just call him a skinny man with no front teeth. It's like this impossibility of capturing this amazing guy at the center.
Well, isn't that about Charlie Kaufman feeling like, capturing himself though too, like there's something about only Charlie Kaufman could bring this character to life because he is as complicated as that character.
Yeah,
you know, he has those same things, and you know it, like, and that's why he makes himself bald, or that's why he makes himself fat, or that's, you know, it's like he, in a way, you know, he's writing himself the way that maybe, and again, I know that they're not all these true things about how he looks, but how people might describe him, and trying to show that there's humanity behind this, oh, this squirrely, skinny, whatever, however you might describe Charlie Kaufman. Like, and he's doing, I think he's, part of it is him, I think, taking care of that character. Only Charlie Kaufman could write a character like that, not in an exploitative way.
Well, yeah, and he gives John a minute to kind of fight back, because like as much as this John guy kind of paints himself as like, I'm the genius of the world, I'm smart, I'm competent, I can do anything, we see him fail. Like he takes Susan into the swamp. He can't figure out their way out. He's trying to make a sundial when there's not even any sun anywhere, and he can't even get the stick to stand up straight. And so all of the insecurities that like Charlie feels that he tries to like wrestle with and that he feels are like subsuming him, and only if he could be more raw and natural, in that scene in the swamp where John is failing, he has all of those insecurities too. It's just he projects them outward, and he starts screaming, as we hear him here, at Meryl Streep that she just needs to get a life. That all these people are like parasitically living off him the way these orchids are living off of trees.
You're just like everybody else, fucking leeches. You just attach yourself to me and suck me dry, spit me out. You know, why don't you get your own fucking life, your own fucking interest? Fucking spoiled bitch.
So I don't know. There's something in this I think is interesting, like that it's almost saying there's only a few people in this world worth telling a story about. But even Susan couldn't figure out how to tell a whole book about this guy.
Well, I think it's also the idea that we all are our own magicians, right? We all present something. And then there'll be a moment where the show is over. You can't, like, you know, a real magician can do amazing feats if properly prepared and in the right environment.
A real Chris Angel.
A real Chris Angel.
Yeah.
and
sorry, I was just listening to the episode of Podcast The Ride that was about Chris Angel's Oh, I can't even say this out loud.
No.
Kablip?
Kablip, yes. Yeah, I'm very familiar with Criss Angel's restaurant that I was supposed to go on that trip, and we actually went on Human Giant. We did things in that show as the Illusionators, who were a parody of Criss Angel, that Criss Angel has now done for real, which blows my mind. We had a restaurant called Illusion Eaters. He has a restaurant now, Kablip.
Criss Angel's breakfast, lunch, and pizza.
Yes. And we also had something really awful happen to him on stage. We did almost verbatim the same bit that he did. It's really wild. But anyway,
Criss Angel has Knights of the Soul like Charlie Kaufman does.
I don't know. Maybe.
Who am I? Should I still be wearing these spangled jeans?
I remember Criss Angel was working out of Madison Square Garden after Madison Scare Garden, and he would be the final 15 minutes. Here's what I'll say, that magicians, you know, if they aren't properly in the right environment, they can't be magicians because they're not warlocks. They don't have magical powers, right? And that's what happens to Chris Cooper's character. Like, he can sell these stories. He can be a smooth guy. You know, he could do all these moments when he has all the right facilities. But that moment, he has to show himself too. Like, no one is Indiana Jones, right? Like, you know, you're going to have these ups and downs. So I think that's interesting. You know, I also think it's really interesting that it's just luck that it was Chris Cooper, because Joaquin Phoenix was supposed to do this part and he took himself out of the running. It was final meetings with Spike Jonze. And he's like, I'm not right for this part. And he's so not right for this part in my mind. At 2002, Joaquin Phoenix seems way too young to be that.
To have had so many lives.
Yeah. And Chris Cooper seems so perfect. I mean, that's also just a chance at great casting. I mean, but I was really interested. I was like, wow, Spike Jonze took Joaquin all the way, you know, to the end. And not that he couldn't do it. I mean, I think Joaquin Phoenix is a great actor. It's just like, that Chris Cooper feels to me, he's got the look. It's a different.
He's exactly right.
Yeah.
He does have like the posture of al dente spaghetti.
Just going back to like the main thrust of this, you know, I told you, like, I really connect with Charlie Kaufman. Do you now, like, I thought, like, oh, this is the universal truth of this movie, that everyone feels this way. Or do you look at it and go, like, this guy is this way? Or how do you, as a writer?
I connect with him completely. I just thought you were happier than me.
No. I mean, but that.
No, like, sitting there at your desk and distracting yourself with 9 million thoughts. And then I sit there and I'm like, what if I took up this? Why don't I learn my Spanish? What's wrong with me? Like,
yeah.
I come up with a whole alternate histories of how I could live my life because I don't want to sit down and write my book.
No, there are so many things that the self-doubt. And I think there's something really beautiful about this movie because in many respects, I think the hardest thing about self-doubt and critical thinking is it can lock you in a box, right? It can put you in a box that you can't get out of. And I feel like we're constantly watching Charlie Kaufman trying to get out of that box, whether that is with someone he's dating, somebody he's interested in, trying to write this, but not write it in a cliche way, trying to connect to people on set. And his brother has an easy time at it because he's not critical of himself. He can meet everybody on set. He starts dating Maggie Gyllenhaal, which also blew my mind that she was in it. I forgot she was in it. And it's crazy that she's in such a small part. And, you know, you see him navigate the world better. I think one, like, personal, but I'll say it. Like, I think, like, one year for, like, New Year's, I was like, oh, you know, sometimes I just wish I'd be more naive, right? Because there's a way that you can game the system. You can be like, well, I'm going to protect myself. I won't get hurt by this. I won't do this. And I think this movie is arguing for that. It's just like arguing to, why does it have to be so hard? Why do you have to put up all these things? Why do you have to be so critical of yourself? Because it's not only like people don't recognize it, but you don't even get any credit for it, right? Like, there's no credit given. Now, granted,
Tilda's still saying, I'd love to be in your head. And you're like, no, it's miserable. It's miserable.
Yeah.
But it's weird because I think I'm very self-critical, and I've always told myself that that's great because I feel like the world hasn't been hard enough on me. So I'm like, I've got to do it. And I thought it kept me in balance. And now I'm wondering if that's a problem. Like, because, you know, when I was a kid, I never did homework. I was like, who needs it? And I was fine.
Right.
And I think there's something in me that's like, you skated by too much. Like, someone has to crack the whip on you. And so it's me.
That's interesting because I always feel like if I'm able to get to myself at a critical place, I won't be surprised by it if someone else comes at it. Like I can do the damage before I hear it from somebody. It's like, you know what I'm saying? It's like if I punch myself in the face, right. It won't hurt to get punched in the face because I know what it feels like to get punched in the face. You know, and that's and I think all of these things are these ways to protect ourselves from doing exactly like this movie is made because at one point Charlie Kaufman, who has this idea, like when he gets the script during the middle of Malkovich, he's having a hard time trying to figure out the real Charlie Kaufman. And it's shown here. And I love how the movie opens in footage of being John Malkovich, real footage.
They had to redo it. They had to rebuild the set. Yeah.
Wait, that moment with John Malkovich when he's telling everyone to be quiet?
I think that is
a documentary of the film and then the rebuilding of the set.
Oh, right. Yes. Okay, right. When you see Catherine Keener climb up the stairs and you have to think that's a rebuild.
Yeah, because when they cut to Nicolas Cage in that scene, it's clearly
a
not
closet.
Yeah. It's not like it's the same type of film, but it's not It's not on set.
Okay, that makes sense. Because I like heard they had to rebuild it and like get John Cusack back, but that would make more sense then. They didn't say they got John Malkovich back, which
I think that was like from a documentary.
Well, then
good
for John Malkovich taking care of like all the people wearing his rubber outfits.
The great actors are so cognizant of that.
And what also makes that interesting is like this being John Malkovich is presented in adaptation almost like a classic. Mm-hmm. You know, and it was really their first film, and this is only their second. So it hasn't had time to even become like a classic.
I know, but it also like it's like an Easter egg for those who know. And if you've never seen Malkovich, it just seems weird. It just seems like, okay, well, I'm telling you, like that's a big actor. You're seeing these things, and but I guess what I was going to with this is like he has to get out of his way to make this movie, right? Like he can't like this movie is him dealing with writer's block and him worrying about a follow-up, right? Like, because that is what this is. And what is he going to do? And he wants to be as original. I think when you make a movie like being John Malkovich, you want to be like, well, how can I tell a more original story? Yeah. And that's like, I would imagine the pressure is on.
Because he's only starting to climb his way into any sort of fame. Like he's been tooling around for a long time. This is a guy who was writing spec scripts for Married with Children that never got made. He wrote one called Al's Well That Ends Al. And I would just love to read that.
Well, I was at a taping of the Dana Carvey sketch show that he was a writer for, which has one of the best, you know, writing staffs of all time. And that's a whole other thing you can get involved with. But there's a great, great documentary called Too Funny to Fail. It's a whole Dana Carvey show documentary about this cast. I mean, this cast of not actors, but like this writer's room that is one of the most insane writer's rooms you would ever possibly put together.
That's so wild. Yeah. But yeah, like he needs this. Like he's so unfamous when he starts working on adaptation that when they tell Susan Orlean, like, oh, this is who's writing your movie, she's never heard of the guy. They get the title wrong, right? Like, listen to this.
They said to me, oh, we've got this great young screenwriter, Charlie Kaufman. He just finished a movie called Killing John Malkovich. And that was the wrong title, but I thought Killing John Malkovich must be one of these like Saw or Halloween, and I thought, I don't get it.
So it's weird. Like, I think if he made adaptation today, right now, being the Kaufman that we know with a character called Kaufman, we'd be like, oh, get over yourself. Who are you? There'd be like, I think, an irritation to it. Mm-hmm. But the audacity to do this when he's not really famous yet, I kind of love that. Like, if somebody's like, you're going to care about me. You're going to care about me, and I'm played by Nicolas Cage. But also, I don't care about me, so it keeps it from feeling too egotistical.
Well, because it's not like – I've talked to so many people, like, who will pitch me an idea for a show. It's like, all right, I want to do my Curb. And the truth is, that's a crazy thing to fucking say because – all that means is you think that your life is so interesting, like that you are the main character. Like we all are the main characters in our own lives. But like Curb is done by arguably one of the best comedy writers of all time, right? Who has one of the most distinctive points of view.
Who was willing to lend his point of view out for much of his career until he got older.
And you can't just say that, well, that just translates to anything. Like, look, and obviously there's a lot of success with that. Like the Kardashians, I would argue, are on the other side of that spectrum. They have lent out their life. And it's not comedic, but I think a lot of people think, oh, I just want to tape me going to the store and that's going to be funny. I'm going to tape the... So, but what this, I think, attacks more and why I think it works and why it's not like as navel-gazy as it could possibly be is we don't know the world of writers. This is not a glamorous world. This is not... This is a little bit of, oh, wow, like this is as interesting as what Chris... Cooper does in the movie, what John LaRoche does, because it is, it's not like, oh, I'm a celebrity dealing with being a celebrity and I hate being famous or whatever the issue is. It is, to most people, I don't think they even understand like how you even would get a movie or how you adapt a thing or how you go about it. And I also think it is the self, I think it does capture a universal, and that's why I was asking you, like a universal self-doubt that we all have. Like, how do we move forward? And are we all thinking like, oh, I shouldn't take a shortcut. I shouldn't do this. And why we sometimes don't take the hands that are, offered out to us. There's, I mean, that Robert McKee lecture is Robert McKee is a big part of this movie and he's not really in the movie for that much. He's in the movie for a very crucial point. And we had Brian Cox on the show for his top three. He's great. And he's fantastic as Robert McKee. And what a great reveal. But this idea that
McKee will say that he cast him himself.
That
when they came to McKee, basically somebody was like, so there's this script in your character and they're using your copyrighted material and they're making fun of it and they're talking about your Ten Commandments. Is this okay? That Robert McKee said he would on a couple conditions. And one of them was that he would cast his own guy. And so like he kicked around a bunch of people. He was like, who's it going to be? Who's it going to be? Who's it going to be? Because this is a guy with a lot of clout. Mm-hmm. He's a guy who knows a lot of people. Like, here is a list of some of Robert McKee's, like, students that have been in his seminar. Are you ready for this? Mm-hmm. It's, like, crazy. David Bowie, John Cleese, Kirk Douglas, Faye Dunaway, Emilio Estevez, Andrew Stanton from Pixar, Quincy Jones, Peter Jackson, Diane Keaton, Barry Manilow, Joan Rivers, Julia Roberts, Meg Ryan, Jill Schumacher, Brooke Shields, Gloria Steinem. He can call anybody he wants at this point to like be who he is. And so he's like going through people in his head. He's thinking about Albert Finney. He's thinking about Christopher Plummer. He's thinking about Terrence Stamp. He's thinking about Michael Caine. And why he finally decided not to go with any of them is he felt like all of those actors had like a love me, he's called it, mm-hmm. character to their work. And he wanted to play a McKee that nobody loved. And like, it's funny. Somebody asked him once like, well, does this represent you? And here's what he said.
How accurate is that scene?
Oh, I took my son to a screening and I asked my son what he thought. And he said, Dad, he nailed you. I said, is that what it's like? Because I was empathizing with the writer, Mm-hmm. I said, gosh, is that what it's like to be on the receiving end of me? And my son said, yes. I said, well, I would never want to be on the receiving end of me.
But that said, like, what I think is funny about even just this McKee sequence to begin with is like, finally, he goes to this seminar. He's sitting there. He's like paid money to like listen to this genius. And like the movie shows us that he's not even listening. That the whole time McKee is talking, he's just talking to himself and his own neuroses are like even drowning out what he's hearing.
What the fuck am I doing here? What the fuck am I doing here? Fuck. It is my weakness, my ultimate lack of conviction that brings me here. Easy answers, rules to shortcut yourself to success. And here I am, because my jaunt into the abyss brought me nothing. Well, isn't that just the risk one takes for attempting something new? I should leave here right now. I'll start over. I need to face this project head on.
And God help you if you use voiceover in your work, my friends. God help you. It's flaccid, sloppy writing. Any idiot can write voiceover narration to explain the thoughts of a character. Okay, that's it. 1 hour for lunch.
Yeah, it's interesting because, look, it does make fun of McKee, but at the same time, it's the devil and the angel on your shoulder, right? Because everything that his brother says is defending it. And Charlie, like, and the idea that I think that's the through line of it is Charlie's like, I want to buck convention. I want to buck trends. And I want to do something so different. And what McKee is saying is make your genre interesting, make your world interesting, but you still have to commit to the goals of storytelling. And that kind of head-to-head moment that they have when they sit down is him wrestling, I think, with McKee, like him going like, yeah, do all the things that you want. You just still have to tell the tenet of story. Like, you don't have to make it. It's like story isn't formulaic. Story is, I mean, I'm now sounding like Donald, but it's like story is structure, you know, formula, you know, like you can make something complete. This movie has, I think, story structure. It may not be a formulaic story, but it's got story structure.
Yeah, but at the same time, what I think is, like, it feels like another even level underneath that, too, is that when McKee yells at him, when Kaufman says he wants to do something like real life and real life isn't dramatic, you get this, like, crazy monologue from McKee right here.
You write a screenplay without conflict or crisis, you'll bore your audience to tears. Secondly, nothing happens in the world? Are you out of your fucking mind? People are murdered every day. There's genocide, war, corruption. Every fucking day, somewhere in the world, somebody sacrifices his life to save somebody else. Every fucking day, someone somewhere takes a conscious decision to destroy someone else. People find love. People lose it. For Christ's sake, a child watches a mother beaten to death on the steps of a church. Someone goes hungry. Somebody else betrays his best friend for a woman. If you can't find that stuff in life, then you, my friend, don't know crap about life. And why the fuck are you wasting my two precious hours with your movie?
I mean, and honestly, when you hear of what he's listing as the real world, it's all just like over-the-top, gigantic, negative stuff that, yeah, like, sure, it happens, but it's like still not kind of real world. Like, that's not even his own world. And I find that kind of like all the movies he's describing sound like boring movies. I don't want to see the movies he's describing either, because I feel like I've seen all of those like dramatic real world stuff. And like, just because something is kind of happening, does that make it interesting? I mean, to me, I feel like this movie winds up being like, to the McKee seminar process, what Sideways is to Merlot. Fair or not? Because I think Merlot is actually a wonderful wine, and I feel very bad that like Merlot got screwed over by Sideways. But I do think it kind of makes a joke of the whole thing, to the point that I wonder like what the effect was. Did it make him tons more popular, or did it make him kind of a joke?
I think, look, he clearly is still around. He's 81 years old. He's making these things. There's anything can be used in the right and wrong hands, right? It's sort of like, I think about it like dieting. Like, is dieting bad? No. You know, if you want to lose weight, you want to do your thing. But is like, if you're going, I'm now Atkins and I'm just going to eat this. And, you know, it's like you can warp anything to make it bad. And you can also turn it to make it good. Like the idea of like the journey of the hero, you know, Dan Harmon, you know, swears by this and talks about like this idea of, you know, everything has to, you know, work on this circular level. And that's Rick and Morty episodes. And that's Community episodes. And I would argue that Dan Harmon is viewed as one of the most interesting storytellers that are out there. Like, I think it's like a respect for the genre. You can't say I'm writing a book and then not put anything in the book. Like, you have to, I think that boundaries are always really good to help you, to help people understand what they're getting into. Like, I think, and it's about how can you subvert those, but also I think keep an emotional through line. And I think McKee says that they hold that scene with him is like, we have to care. Like, we have to care. There's still reasons we have to care. We have to change. Like, life does happen. Like, this idea of like this, I don't know. I think that the idea, and this is where going back to what we said in the beginning, like Charlie Kaufman, I think, wants to be in more of that verite. Like, I want you to see this sadness, this loneliness, this feeling. And I think Spike Jonze is like, yes. And like, how does it actually fit in the world that we live in? Like, how, you know, can we take that out and make it like a little bit more universal? I think that's like this is why this movie, in as dark as it is, and it is dark, is more successful than Synecdoche, because Synecdoche is, I love that movie. I love that movie.
It is one of the top, I will maybe now say, three greatest movies ever made, because I'm leaving space for me to leave everything ever.
I thought you were going to say I'm leaving space balls on the, wow, all right. No,
my top two movies ever made, Synecdoche, New York, and Pennies from Heaven, are now leaving space for me to sit on it and see if I want to put everything up there.
Okay.
Tied as the Holy Trinity.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Post James Brown syncopated ghost notes on the snare. This is just like boom, cat.
I love right. Bruno Mars. I think I could play that.
There's nothing complicated, but that's kind of, that's the genre.
Hi, I'm director and sometimes DJ Diallo Riddle.
And I'm producer and songwriter Luxury.
And this is One Song, a podcast where we celebrate and deconstruct some of your favorite songs from the last 60 years and tell you why they deserve one more listen. Follow and listen to One Song on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is all about wrestling with who are we? Are we the person who can defy conventions but play within conventions? Like, this is Charlie Kaufman making a major movie. Like, he didn't think this movie was going to go. He had an idea for what he wanted to do with the adaptation. He's like, I'm not even going to pitch it. I'm just going to give it to them. And the studio gets so excited. They're like, let's fast track it. And they start to fast track this movie. And it's going.
After getting Susan Orlean so drunk that she agrees to it finally.
Wow.
They had to take her to lunch. And they were like, here, Susan, have a cocktail. Then you can read the script. Actually, let's have some wine. Actually, let's have an after-dinner drink. They, like, plied her with alcohol before they broke the news. It was very funny.
But to me, it just seems like it is about, you know, I think Robert McKee is there to be, like, the fact that Robert McKee provides the answer to the movie. Like, he does have to go to Robert McKee to finish the movie. Like, in the meta world of this movie, without that Robert McKee beat, you don't have the ending. You don't have that idea that I need to do this.
Well, actually, without Robert McKee, you don't have this ending at all. Because that was his second demand before he let them use their stuff. Was he was like, actually, I don't like the ending of the script that you've sent me. I demand that I get to help reshape it.
Talk about how this came to be in this movie with you.
Well, I was sitting in my office one day and the phone rings and it's this producer from New York. And he said, this is the most embarrassing phone call I've ever had to make. He said, there's this crazy writer, Charlie Kaufman, who's written a script. He's made you a character in it. He's freely copied from your book and your lectures without copyright permission. We don't know what to do. I said, well, send me a copy. Mm-hmm. So I read the screenplay and I saw it was wonderful. It had third act problems, but I saw what he needed. He needed somebody to push up against. He needed my character to represent everything that he was against in terms of wanting to be an artist in the commercial world of Hollywood. Mm-hmm. And I said, I know I'm a controversial figure, so fine, we'll play with that. And I said, we get some laughs. I said, I'll do anything for a laugh. I said, but I want my redeeming scene, and I want a say in the casting, and I want us to fix Act 3 because I can't be a character in a bad movie.
And so, how'd they take that?
They listened because they knew they had Act 3 problems. Yeah. And so I sat down with Charlie and Spike, the director, for many meetings and went over the notes, and they reworked Act 3 accordingly, and the rest was history.
Yeah, which I think is fascinating that McKee actually might have written this, because I will say probably my least favorite bit of this movie is the ending. I don't love it.
I love it.
It's like just a lot of kind of generic action. You've got that like generic thriller music they put in right here.
That's the thing. That's the meta.
It's so meta that I don't find it that interesting. It's like almost too deadpan. I'm like, whatever. But do you want to know what happened in his earlier draft?
Sure.
Now? Okay. So in his earlier draft, he exaggerates things more. Like Kaufman makes Donald even more of a hero. Like in this ending fight, Donald grabs an alligator and like cuts off its head himself. Like cuts off the alligator's head. And then he like turns to Charlie and he goes, you've got a fucking awesome third act. And then like Susan Orlean starts like fighting with Charlie and she's like about to kill him. And Charlie says to Susan something I think probably feels like the underpinning of so much of the emotion in this book. He's like, I just wish you would write a description of me as nice as the one that you wrote for John. As nice as the al dente spaghetti. But she can't do it and she tries to kill him. And then Donald pops back up when you think he's dead and then he kills Susan. And then you get this whole message that this movie is about how you have to learn to love yourself before you can love anything.
I think that that movie that you just described undercuts why the third act. Yes. Because
you don't want to see Susan Orlean die?
No, because I think what that does is it makes it too meta. Like, there's something really interesting about riding the line tonally. Like, it almost like it, and this is where we're going back to, like, the emotionality of it. Like, that's a funny ending. That's a very sketch comedy, big, like, oh, yeah. And what you get in this other version of it is, like, I think it bend it, don't break it, right? That idea of, like, and I think that that ending bends it and breaks it. Because when Donald dies, it means something. When you see Meryl Streep unraveling, that means something. Why it means something. Why she is afraid. There are stakes. There are characters. And to me, the whole movie, I think, leads up to this one moment.
Well, how come you were so happy? I love Sarah, Charles. It was mine. That love. I owned it. And Sarah didn't have the right to take it away. I can love whoever I want. She thought you were pathetic. That was her business, not mine. You are what you love, not what loves you.
You don't have that moment in what you just described. There's no room for that moment. That moment to me is the whole thing.
I mean, it's there. But it's like there's bigger stuff around it.
But that to me, I think, like, these moments where they actually are afraid. Like, I'm afraid of Meryl Streep in that thing. Like, Meryl Streep is like a drug addict who has lost her mind. And seeing Chris Cooper wrestle with the idea of picking up a rifle and trying to kill them. And yes, the alligator is a crazy moment. Uh-huh. But that, like, that crazy.
The love story of the decade, according to Paul Scherer.
I love it. But I mean, when that alligator comes and gets him, like, holy shit. And that's.
The Deus right about Ex Machina that they're making fun of.
Yes, but you're talking about a third act that's all Deus Ex Machina.
There's also like a giant swamp creature in the original one.
That's what I'm saying.
This is Swamp Man kills John.
Like, this is clever enough not to take you out of it, because it still gives you this like through line where you're like, the stakes were raised, and then only in that moment, like, you need to see them bond.
You're still seeing them bond. I think when it gets more actiony, it becomes everything he didn't want it to be.
But that's what you're describing, though.
I know, but I think, like, I like his giant action more than I like the normal action. I think the normal action is kind of boring in the film. I would prefer a giant Kaufman-esque action spectacular than to, like, the sort of granular one that I think McKee maybe put on it more. I don't know. I think the ending almost proves why everything that he was rebelling against didn't work. You know, like, why you don't want to do this kind of movie? Because it's hard for me. I really have a really hard time caring about, like, the last half hour of this film.
Really? To me, that's the whole... I mean, that scene you just played, that love scene, like...
That scene's great. But everything else. All the action stuff, I'm like, eh.
But, I mean, there's... Look, we're talking about, you know, this moment where I love when Chris Cooper is like, you're going to put me in the movie? Who's going to play me? Like, this idea, like, you know, like, even he, this person who doesn't care, probably hasn't even watched movies, like, is, like, now interested. He's naked. Like, there's so many great little moments there as they're kind of uncovering this. But why I think the movie works is that final scene with Charlie and his girlfriend at that mall, you know, outdoor mall in Los Angeles. And he's got a great third act, and he goes in his car and drives away. Like, that still, to me, like, the movie takes like a 10-minute detour to do the traditional Hollywood movie, but it still ends in the Charlie Kaufman ending. I mean, it still gives you that moment, like the car driving off and him going,
and
the flowers.
I have to go right home. I know how to finish the script now. It ends with Kaufman driving home after his lunch with Amelia, thinking he knows how to finish the script. Shit, that's voiceover. McKee would not approve. How else can I show his thoughts? I don't know. Oh, who cares what McKee says? It feels right. Conclusive. I wonder who's gonna play me. Someone not too fat. I like that Gerard Depardieu, but can he not do the accent? Anyway, it's done, and that's something. So, Kaufman drives off from his encounter with Amelia, filled for the first time with hope. I like this. This is good.
The beauty of the flowers in front of Kaiser Permanente on Sunset in Hollywood.
But there, yeah, to me there is something, I think if you make that ending so meta, you miss out on the idea of saying, can't you do a little bit of both? And I would argue Eternal Sunshine of a Spotless Mind is the product of this movie. I think it is saying, I can do something as inventive and interesting that has a core center that is emotionally fulfilling and it follows beats and it can subvert the expectations. It can be a love story that doesn't end positively, but it can also be a story about how to get through breakup, and people have tried to do that and it doesn't really work. And he does that. And it's like that movie is the distillation of this movie's thesis. And, you know, that's how I kind of look at it.
I do too. And then I think that Synecdoche is just the masterpiece of all of it. But I love them all. I mean, I love Eternal Sunshine.
Yeah.
I love Eternal Sunshine. But I will say this. I think one of my favorite things that they do with the character of, like, Donald in this, the guy who represents all of the movies that, you know, Charlie doesn't think he wants to make, I appreciate that Donald himself is, like, sweet and naive and hopeful. And he looks up to Charlie. He's, like, the only person who calls Charlie Charles. I think Charlie actually does really good stuff in the script, where just the way the names that people use for each other tell you so much about the character themselves. The idea that John is always calling Susan Susie Q.
Yeah.
And, like, that's something Charlie Kaufman himself could have never done in person. He just is so detailed in that kind of way. But I love that Donald is not some sort of cynical hack, because I feel like that'd be the easier way of writing Donald. He's like, yes, doing Garfield 6, and he's like, just put in some car chases, bada bing, bada boom, you know, like a real cornball. I love that he finds the sweetness of Donald and puts that center.
Well, that's that line. Like, I love, like, he wants to make these movies. Like, he, like, I have an issue with this idea that any creator is so cynical that they're creating something shitty, right? Like, I was reading this response to somebody was talking about, you know, why is there a hatred to Shrek, and why is the popularity? Because the Shrek thing has been really interesting than we did on the show.
He has risen,
which is I put on my Instagram there. And someone was saying, like, oh, I think the reason why, like, Garfield and Shrek are used so much in shit posting, like, online, is because it's such a cynical point of view. Like, and I was thinking about this. I'm like, I don't think, you know, Jim Davis, he may not be, like, the most astute, writer of the human condition, but Jim, you know, but he is, you know, I don't think he's approaching Garfield by going, like, ah, fuck it, I'm gonna give these people whatever they want. Like,
but
there's
he's got a Kaufman-esque beauty to it too, that he's, yeah, doing a comic strip about a man like himself in his relationship with his kid.
I love it.
Investing himself in his work.
Well, yes.
And I will be honest, I think Garfield minus Garfield, mm-hmm, where you realize that it's just John talking to himself, that it's a story of a man lonely in his own house without Garfield's response, mm-hmm, talking to his cat, a thing I can relate to quite deeply. I think, honestly, it brings a tear to my eye, some of those panels.
Well, that's all I'm saying is, like, this idea that anyone is creating something in such a cynical way to just make money, those people I don't think are successful. There might be people, there might be producers, there might be studios who go, hey, we're going to put this face on the poster and this is going to get us money. And you know what? Who cares? It's got this and it will work. Right? I think that there are definitely...
I mean, I think producers can be cynical, but I think
do too.
Artists are not.
That's what I was going to get to. I think that the business can be cynical. But I think when you're creating something, I really do believe it's hard to create something that you don't give a fuck about. Like, and it may come across, and people might think it's lame or not cool, but this idea of a cynical creator, it's like, well, why do it? There's enough other elements there. And you have to live with this stuff and work with this stuff. Like, I get the idea, like, oh, I might not want to do this, but I think when you're writing something and you're in it,
you make, like, yourself fall in love.
You, yes,
do. Or you say no. Like Kaufman,
right,
does Being John Malkovich. He says everybody just wants to send him these, like, comedy sci-fi books And he doesn't want to do it. He doesn't want to do it. Like, he's looking for something that'll stir his soul, like adaptation, something that stirs you enough that you feel like you have to do it. It's the producer end, the Tilda of it, who can't think of anything original to say besides John LaRoche is a really interesting character and boy, do you have a unique voice. And she says the same thing to Kaufman in the movie that she says to Susan Orlean. It's the producer who has no insight.
Well, yeah, I mean, and that's not all, but yes, but yeah, I agree. Well, yeah,
there are good producers.
And I guess what I'm thinking is why Donald is so interesting and what makes Charlie so interesting in this movie is that he's able to write the idea that Donald is just a fan. They might have the same sensibilities. He might not like the same things, but he's genuine in what he wants to do. Like, he loves this idea. Like, and he is open to feedback and he is willing to expose himself. He takes chances. He talks to, a girl. He lets he lets people read his script. He takes notes. He engages people. He makes them feel like, you know, I can say that how many times you can go, it's not ready or it's not this. You try to hide behind it as if someone's always trying to like find you out. I do think that the end that I would have liked to have seen is there was going to be a bit of the three shown at the very end of the credits of the movie. Did you hear about this?
Uh-uh.
All right. So it was going to be like, so there was a scene that was written but not shot. And it said that it reads like this. We're all one thing, Lieutenant. That's what I've come to realize. Like cells in a body, except we can't see the body. The way fish can't see the ocean. And we envy each other, hurt each other, hate each other. How silly is that? A heart cell hating a lung cell. And that's Cassie from the three. That's her line.
Be played by Maggie Gyllenhaal.
And they said that this is the theory that claims that this is maybe what the whole movie is about, the hidden meaning of the film. You know, that Donald, Susan, and Charlie are the three.
Yeah. That's what I want to ask you about. Because there's that scene when Donald, who, by the way, as a character, like, stretches back beyond this movie. Like, Charlie Kaufman included Donald in the press notes for Being John Malkovich. He invented this twin and who knows? But he says in the production notes that, like, Charlie mailed his script for Malkovich to his brother Donald. Donald was serving in the Gulf War at the time. And one of Donald's platoon mates in the Gulf War was friends with Spike Jonze and sent his script to Spike Jonze. And that was Charlie Kaufman's whole story for how Being John Malkovich get made. So Donald has a long history.
I love it.
But there is that scene right after Donald pitches Charlie in the middle of the night about, like, his idea for the three, where Charlie tells him why a movie like this can't be made. I feel like in this conversation, they're just describing adaptation itself, all of the problems with this movie itself. And I feel like maybe there's something even more going on here.
The other thing is, there's no way to write this. Did you consider that? I mean, how could you have somebody held prisoner in a basement and working in a police station at the same time?
Trick photography.
Okay, that's not what I'm asking. Listen closely. What I'm asking is, in the reality of this movie, where there's only one character, right? Okay? How could you... What exactly would... I agree with Mom. Very taut. Sybil meets... I don't know.
I want to float something at you.
Yeah.
In this whole movie, Charlie's been describing what he doesn't want to make, and it turns out to be what the movie is. In this scene, is he tipping his hand that maybe this whole movie is a movie just about one character? That this whole movie is only taking place inside of Charlie Kaufman's head? That we're just in his head, there is no Donald, that this is only a movie, like living in the world of a writer's neuroses.
I know that he interacts with Donald a little bit, but very rarely do they interact with like another, like he interacts with Donald privately a lot, but you know, you don't really see him publicly with Donald. So I was thinking about that. It's only that party where you get to see that moment. But
I wonder, like, if the whole thing is a fantasy. Because, like, you know, this whole movie is like Charlie sliding into different fantasies of who's having sex
with. It's like Walter Mitty,
What if, because this movie starts on blackness where we're just hearing his thoughts. What if we just never leave his thoughts? What if this entire movie is just is happening?
I mean, this is. I mean, I agree with that. And I think what we're talking about, and we talked about this with Chris Cooper in the beginning, how are people presented? Like, he is wrestling, and I think it's like Chris Cooper, like, who is he versus how he's described? Who am I versus what people think I am? Who should I be?
And I am being like, you're this happy guy. And you're like, no, I suffer these neuroses.
I almost feel like because it's interesting. I almost like if you want to keep the idea of the three, I mean, I expand it and say it's the four. But I would say Meryl Streep is wrestling with the same kind of identity crisis as Charlie, as Chris Cooper. Like, right, Chris Cooper and Donald are on this side, which are like, I am who I am, and I am fine with it. They've and both Charlie and Susan, Meryl Streep's character, are trying to figure out who they want to be and how they present themselves. And that's the struggle, like, in many ways. Like, and they both have it. Like, so Meryl has her Donald and Chris Cooper, and I think that Charlie has his Donald and his Donald. And and that's the yin and yang that they're both kind of fighting against. So it's almost like two separate movies representing two journeys of these people that are like, be like me, be happy, just follow your heart, be passionate. Because she says, like, Susan Orlean's like, I don't think I have passion. I don't know if I find passion. And Donald and Donald represents the passion in Charlie's life. Like, he's having so much fun writing a movie. He's going out, he's enjoying this thing, and Charlie is not. He's hating every part of it. He should be enjoying all of his success, or at least feeling good about himself, and it just he can't. And in many ways, Donald has less to be happy about because nothing has been made. And Chris Cooper has less to be happy about because his life has been destroyed. But yet they're able to transcend.
That's beautiful. And by the way, Susan sells herself a little short. She has admitted that she does have a passion for collecting two things, toothpaste and dice.
Well, there you go. Now, you said this movie was not a hit, but I imagine that critically this movie works for a lot of people.
It did. It did. Lots of people adored this movie. This movie really kind of clicked with people. There's some people like Rex Reed who like just said it was a bunch of Z's. Really, the best criticism I found for it comes from a blog. A guy named Jeremy Hillman, who wrote a blog called Movie Martyr, which he seems to have stepped back from in 2012. But his review of it that he read at the time I thought was really sharp. So this is what he said. Adaptation is clearly an intelligent film, but it's intelligent in the worst way. It uses its smarts to build defenses instead of attempting to push closer towards genuine emotion. This failure becomes most obvious in retrospect when the realization dawns that the most affecting, inventive, and honest moments of the film were those that hewed most closely to the original text, which is a lot of the stuff that John says, which is actually is from the book. Even before the film begins indulging itself in cliches, the observation that it makes about Kaufman's struggle in his writing process seems as if it has been culled from the amalgamation of every neurotic writer to ever grace the screen. Adaptation's gambits might be more tolerable if they're at least self-deprecating in original ways, but it chooses shopworn targets for attack time and again. He uses a typewriter, he's socially awkward, etc., etc., etc. For example, its criticisms of Hollywood's artless, commerce-driven mindset seem paradoxical because this film's own existence proves that risk-taking still occurs in Hollywood, even if this risk doesn't exactly pay off.
And yeah, I mean, sure, that's a point of view.
Well, I thought it was smart. Jeremy Hyland, I don't know why you're not still writing, but that was quite good.
I love it. All right, so we know where you stand on this movie. I think, you know, one of the things we haven't done that much, but I don't think we have to like go that much deeper because we've spent a lot of time here, is the Nicolas Cage of it all. It may not be your favorite Charlie Kaufman, but is it, where does it fall for you? And obviously Face Off has a love. We have so much love for Face Off, but where do you fall on this?
You know, what's interesting. I was realizing I was having a very hard time watching this film for the Nicolas Cage of it all. I almost never feel this way about a Nicolas Cage film where like, I can't see the Cage, but there's something in Charlie as like meek and unassuming he is, as like timid as Susan Orlean describes him on the set of the film, which was the only time she really met him.
I was watching Nicolas Cage in a scene, and there's this little guy standing over there. I thought, oh, you know, some, you know, one of the script supervisors or something, and I didn't give him much thought. He was shy, retiring, and, you know, little, and suddenly Nicolas Cage stops in the middle of the scene, and he says, "The real Charlie and the real Susan finally meet." And we look at each other. And Charlie said, "Hi." And I said, "I'm really embarrassed." He said, "Not as embarrassed as I am." And he turned around and left. And I then didn't see him for at least a year.
As meek as that guy sounds on paper and describes himself, I can't even see Nicolas Cage in this movie, weirdly, because I only see Kaufman. There's something in the Kaufman brain where it's hard for me to see, to even think of this as a Nicolas Cage movie. The same way that I have a hard time thinking about it as a Spike Jones movie. There's something almost like dictatorship control-wise of Kaufman. Maybe it's just my fascination.
I mean, well,
but
this is an interesting.
I can't even see Cage in here, no matter how hard. It's like I squint and I still really can't.
Well, this is interesting because I think you could argue in many respects, that's a problem that we have with Jim Carrey. And Eternal Sunshine, like we don't see the Jim Carrey that we know. It's a different Jim Carrey. Obviously, Jim Carrey has grown and done different things after that. But he does have a way of blotting out the sun in a way. You know, it becomes something very unique. Nicolas Cage has said that he went against every one of his acting instincts to do this part. And I think in watching it, I see that. And I wonder...
Yeah, it's such a quiet Cage.
Yes.
It's all posture, shoulders, hunching. Yeah.
And I wonder if, you know, to our what our exploration was is like, is this the best Cage? This might be one of the best movies that Nicolas Cage is in. And the performance is a masterful, beautiful performance. But I don't know if this is the performance that is the best Nicolas Cage performance.
I would 100% agree with that. I mean, he gets nominated for Best Actor.
He should. Like, it's a, yeah. But it's like, yeah.
Who do you think he loses to?
I know. The guy who stars in The Pianist.
Yes, yeah, Adrian Brody.
Adrian Brody. Yeah.
Oh, to bring it all the way back around to
get that
time.
Big kiss. Get that big kiss.
Oh, God.
With him and Halle Berry. Most uncomfortable, weird moment. Until recently.
Yeah. I don't know what you're talking about. It's interesting to hear Cage describe Kaufman, like what he wanted to bring to it.
Well, my sense of Charlie Kaufman is that he's a brilliant artist who is very passionate about his craft and very loaded with self-doubt and insecurities that compel him, I think, to really dig a little deeper and free himself. I think he uses his pressure, but this is just my interpretation, of course. To build the character, I did spend a lot of time with Charlie. I did interview him exhaustively, and... I think he was happy when that part of the process was over. And I burned all the tapes out of respect to him. But sometimes we would get in this paranoid place together, I think, I could be wrong, where he would come to the set and I would see him scrutinizing me playing him and I would get uncomfortable and wouldn't want him there, you know. And then I would take him to lunch or dinner to scrutinize him to see what kind of moves I could get to put in the part. And then he would take, like, the menu and start flapping it under his arms like a chicken. I thought, okay, are you messing with me now? You think that that's going to wind up in the movie? And it got very it got very odd.
Surreal, I
imagine. It was very, very – it was one of the more bizarre experiences of my life.
Yeah, no, I'd 1,000% agree with you. Like, this when I think of what is a Cage performance, I actually forget he's in this movie almost every single time. It's bizarre to me. Like, there's some sort of blot. Like, he is the ghost orchid. I can't even... He's in my imagination as being in this film, but it's hard to think about.
I guess what I would say is, I don't think of Nicolas Cage as a method actor. I think that what he does, he's able to go into parts and be truthful in those parts. But yet you always see like a glimmer of him. This movie really extinguishes the glimmer of him and just lets him do the acting. And like, and I think
there is no glimmer in the eye ever.
No. And I think you create like, they're fantastic. And this is a weird thing to say, cause it's like, well, we're missing the persona, right? Like we're like even Tom Cruise in Magnolia, where people go like, oh, that's one of the best Tom Cruise performing. Like it's, you still see Tom Cruise, like you still, And it's great acting, and I'm not saying anything about Tom Cruise, but like there is something here that Spike Jones and Nick Cage and Charlie Kaufman, I think they all got out of the way for the story. And I think in a weird way, you have to do it for this. Like you can't look at this movie and go, oh, that's Nick Cage playing a writer. You have to say like, this is this character. It's like, it's the way that I think that people don't look at Bruno or Borat as Sacha Baron Cohen, right? Like Bruno and Borat are great characters, but I don't think you go, oh, there's Sacha Baron Cohen. I don't know Sacha Baron Cohen under there. I know Bruno, I know Borat, yeah. Or it's just Borat's a better example, but like, yeah, but I think there is something about that where he's so in that it's like, well, this is just that's Charlie Kaufman in a weird way. Until you're telling me what Charlie Kaufman looks like, I think my go-to image is of Nick Cage in this movie.
I wonder if this is the first time Nicolas Cage has even worn like a padded fat suit in a movie.
It was interesting watching it because that padded fat suit looked so, I didn't realize it was a fat suit. And I was like, wow, like it's so like, it's such an odd fat. Like it's just like, it's like, cause it's like his chest is like lumpy. Like it doesn't look bad. It's just like, but it's so like not like rubber tire fat, like around your belly instead of like fat. It's like, it's almost more sad, that kind of fat. It's like, it's, you know, sad. It's like, yeah.
The hair is very sad. It's yeah. All very sad. Although at least Nicolas Cage had a chance to do the idea of double Nicolas Cages and make it funny. Do you remember this clip from Saturday Night Live when he was on Weekend Update where it's Andy Samberg as Cage as real Cage, yes. Mm-hmm. And then Cage as second Cage?
Yeah.
Well, I'm looking at two identical Nick Cages.
Well, Seth, I can explain if you just calm down!
I'm calm.
Okay, as everyone knows, my dream as an actor is to appear in every film ever released. However, until now, I've only been able to muster a measly 90%, bringing shame upon my dojo.
Sure, of course.
But fortunately, today, science has prevailed, and I'm proud to announce that my cloning experiment has finally come to fruition.
I'm sorry, cloning experiment?
Well, that's exactly right, Seth. I am his clone.
Oh. Well, that does make sense, because you two are identical in every way.
Not in every way, Seth. Well, while physically we are exactly the same, there are some slight differences personality-wise. Yes, for example, this Nick is calm and stealthy, like a ninja warrior. Whereas this Nick is an exaggerated, screaming psychopath and really just doesn't exist.
By the way, a connection between Kaufman and comedy. Do you know what one of Kaufman's major influences was as a child?
No.
Monty Python.
Oh,
he said
that,
but for an interesting reason, not just that Monty Python was funny, but he said that Monty Python presented chaos to him. And that it was the chaos of Monty Python that most influenced him as a child.
Interesting. I love that idea. That's a great idea. I mean, it definitely has that. I mean, the idea of like the animations coming in, the scenes having no ending, like there was something that's so different in that kind of sketch. I'll leave you with this, Amy. Before we talk about our next series, which we've been teasing for quite some time, animation. A month of animation.
Pronounce that with more verve, please.
Anna. May Shun. I'll leave you with this. We've talked about this movie, the adaptation of this movie, who played all these roles, but the original person set for Charlie Kaufman, Tom Hanks.
He could do it. Although, has he ever been sad?
I don't think, oddly, Tom Hanks would have been as good in this role. Not because he's not a good actor, but I almost think, and I know Nick Cage is very famous, but to your point, what we just talked about, he's able to disappear very deeply that you don't even see a glimmer of it. And maybe Tom Hanks would have been able to do it. Maybe that would have been directed and done great. I love Tom Hanks. No slight on Tom Hanks. But I think you needed to pick a lead actor off of center. Like like not a Will Smith, not a Tom Cruise, not a, just because there would make, it would make him more endearing. And I think this character can't be, you can feel the emotional weight of him, but he can't be like, oh, I love, like you can't, Donald needs to, but like, it's going to be a tougher thing. I don't know.
I'm thinking about it. Like the closest thing I can think of for Tom Hanks would be like Joe versus the Volcano.
Mm-hmm.
That's the closest to this character. But even then, there's just, you look at Tom Hanks and you're like, no, that guy's a winner.
Or you emotionally connect to him. Like, I think Nicolas Cage can keep you at distance. Mm-hmm. Like, I think that is part of his charm, too. He's not the, oh my gosh, every time I see him, I'm so excited. It's like, we love him because we all know what Nicolas Cage is. And I think there are certain actors out there that you just like, have I ever seen a bad Denzel Washington movie? Like, sure, but like a bad Denzel Washington movie is like bad pizza. It's like, that's fine. It's like, it's like at worst, you know, because they carry it. And I think that this movie You know, it's interesting, these like little choices that make it a little bit different, just a little bit different. And I'm not saying that, you know, maybe it would have been great, but I'm glad that we get Chris Cooper. I'm glad that we get Nicolas Cage. And I love this performance from Meryl Streep, which is like a joyful, interesting, deep performance. And I, you know, I just will be remiss if I don't talk about one of my favorite scenes in the whole movie, which is where he goes, tells her to go fuck off. Like in that moment when Charlie and Meryl Streep are like in that moment at the end, like that's him. Like, I think what you're doing is you're watching him merge all the characters into one.
He's been telling himself to fuck off in his own head, and finally he gets somebody else to do it for
him. It's the most emotion and true emotion and who he is in a way that it's him not holding back. And I think that's like the blending. That's like, and then that moment he blends all these people together. The three become one. Or the four become one. Anyway, animation starts, Amy, and we are going to start it off. I think there's a couple of people who are like, hey, you only talk about like a lot of animated films that are family films or you exist in the Pixar world. Like, so let's start it off with a favorite. And I think also, and I'll just talk about animation, we have given Japanese animation, we've talked about it, but we have never really addressed it on the show. We've never done any anime on the show, and I think we should start it off with a legend, a classic.
The heavy hitter.
Akira. Take a listen to the trailer.
Neo Tokyo is about to explode. Streamline Pictures presents a state-of-the-art adventure, Akira.
And Akira is available wherever you can stream your films, or also check out your local public library. They have a system called Hoopla, which is amazing. You can rent movies for free without even having to go to the library. Just use the resources of your local public library. As always, we have some Unspooled merch out and available. Just go to tpublic.com/unspooled. You'll see the latest shirts. We'll get some more up there, but we're always open to ideas. And you can always tell us what you're thinking about the show. We are creating a much bigger Unspooled section right now on my Discord at discord.gg/Paul Scheer. Great conversations going on there for all the past episodes. So get on there. A big thank you to our producer, Josh Richmond, our sound engineer, Devin Bryant, our producer, Molly Reynolds, and of course, our intern who we're saying goodbye to today for our last show, who's been cutting together all these amazing videos and helping us throughout all the show. A big thank you to Raven Goldston.
We will miss you, Raven. You've been wonderful.
Yes, we will. And we will see you next week for Akira.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
I'm Katie Rich. I'm one of the hosts of Vanity Fair's Little Gold Men podcast. Every week, we cover the ups and downs of the Oscar race, from Barbenheimer to the Golden Globes controversy, and much more. We also have weekly interviews with some of the year's biggest contenders, like Emma Stone, Paul Giamatti, and America Ferrera. Whether you're a Hollywood insider or just want to win your office's Oscar pool, listen to Little Gold Men, available on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening now.